Evolution. The sciences have developed in an order the reverse of what might have been expected. What was most remote from ourselves was first brought under the domain of law, and then gradually what was nearer. First the heavens, next the earth, then animal and vegetable life, then the human body, and last of all, as yet very imperfectly, the human mind. In this there is nothing inexplicable. Familiarity with detail makes it difficult to see broad patterns. The outlines of roads are more easily traced from an aeroplane than from the ground. A person's friends know what he is likely to do better than he does himself. At a certain turn in the conversation, they foresee the dreadful inevitability of one of his favourite anecdotes, whereas to himself he seems to be acting on a spontaneous impulse, by no means subject to law. The detailed acquaintance, derived from intimate experience, is not the easiest source for the generalized kind of knowledge which science seeks. Not only the discovery of simple natural laws, but also the doctrine of the gradual development of the world as we know it, began in astronomy. But the latter, unlike the former, found its most notable application in connection with the growth of life on our planet. The doctrine of evolution, which we are now to consider, though it began in astronomy, was of more scientific importance in geology and biology, where, also, it had to contend with more obstinate theological prejudices than were brought to bear against astronomy after the victory of the Copernican system. It is difficult for a modern mind to realize how recent is the belief in development and gradual growth. It is, in fact, almost wholly subsequent to Newton. The doctrine of the gradual evolution of plants and animals by descent and variation, which came into biology largely through geology, may be divided into three parts. There is first the fact, as certain as a fact about remote ages can hope to be, that the simpler forms of life are the older, and that those with a more complicated structure make their first appearance at a later stage of the record. Second, there is the theory that the later and more highly organized forms did not arise spontaneously, but grew out of the earlier forms through a series of modifications. This is what is meant by evolution. Third, there is the study, as yet far from complete, of the mechanism of evolution, that is, of the causes of variation and of the survival of certain types at the expense of others. The general doctrine of evolution is now universally accepted among biologists, though there are still doubts as to its mechanism. The chief historical importance of Darwin lies in his having suggested a mechanism, natural selection, which made evolution seem more probable. But his suggestion, while still accepted as valid, is less completely satisfying to modern science than it was to his immediate successors. Darwin's theory was essentially an extension to the animal and vegetable worlds of laissez-faire economics. All living things reproduce themselves so fast that the greater part of each generation must die without having reached the age to leave descendants. A female codfish lays about 9 million eggs a year. Even human populations, though their rate of natural increase is slower than that of any other animals except elephants, have been known to double in 25 years. If this rate continued throughout the world for the next 2 centuries, the resulting population would amount to 500 billion. But we find, in fact, that animal and plant populations are, as a rule, roughly stationary. And the same has been true of human populations at most periods. There is, therefore, both within each species and as between different species, a constant competition, in which the penalty of defeat is death. It follows that if some members of a species differ from others in any way which gives them an advantage, they are more likely to survive. If the difference has been acquired by learning, it will not be transmitted to their descendants. But if it is congenital, it is likely to reappear in at least a fair proportion of their posterity. Darwin's theory depended upon the occurrence of chance variations, the causes of which, as he confessed, were unknown. It is an observed fact that the posterity of a given pair are not at all alike. domestic animals have been greatly changed by artificial selection. Through the agency of humans, cows have come to yield more milk, racehorses to run faster, and sheep to yield more wool. Such facts afforded the most direct evidence available to Darwin of what selection could accomplish. It is true that breeders cannot turn a fish into a marsupial, or a marsupial into a monkey. But changes as great as these might be expected to occur during the countless ages required by the geologists. There was, moreover, in many cases, evidence of common ancestry. Fossils showed that animals intermediate between widely separated species of the present had existed in the past. Darwinism was as severe a blow to theology as Copernicanism. Not only was it necessary to abandon the fixity of species and the many separate acts of creation which the Bible seemed to assert, not only was it necessary to assume a lapse of time since the origin of life, which was shocking to the orthodox. Not only was it necessary to abandon a host of arguments for the beneficence of providence, derived from the exquisite adaptation of animals to their environment, which was now explained as the operation of natural selection. But worse than any or all of these, the evolutionists ventured to affirm that man was descended from the lower animals. Theologians and uneducated people, indeed, fastened upon this one aspect of the theory. Darwin says that people are descended from monkeys, the world exclaimed in horror. It was popularly said that he believed this because he himself looked like a monkey, which he did not. As often happens, the theologians were quicker to perceive the consequences of the new doctrine than were its advocates, most of whom, though convinced by the evidence, were religious men, and wished to retain as much as possible of their former beliefs. Progress, especially during the 19th century, was much facilitated by lack of logic in its advocates, which enabled them to get used to one change before having to accept another. When all the logical consequences of an innovation are presented simultaneously, the shock to habits is so great that people tend to reject the whole, whereas if they had been invited to take one step every 10 or 20 years, they could have been coaxed along the path of progress without much resistance. The theologians, however, saw what was involved more clearly than did the general public. They pointed out that people have immortal souls, which monkeys have not, that people have a divinely implanted sense of right and wrong, whereas monkeys are guided solely by instinct. If humans developed by imperceptible steps out of monkeys, at what moment did they suddenly acquire these theologically important characteristics? Religion, in our day, has accommodated itself to the doctrine of evolution and has even derived new arguments from it. We are told that evolution is the unfolding of an idea which has been in the mind of God throughout. But the same laws which produce growth also produce decay. Some day the sun will grow cold and life on the earth will cease. The whole epoch of animals and plants is only an interlude between ages that were too hot and ages that will be too cold. There is no law of cosmic progress, but only an oscillation upward and downward, with a slow trend downward on the balance owing to the diffusion of energy. This, at least, is what science at present regards as the most probable, and in our disillusioned generation it is easy to believe.